The Marvel of Hearing, from the Book of Knowledge, edited by Arthur Mee and Holland Thompson, Ph.D. We know something of the brain and the spinal cord, which together are called the central nervous system, in the upper part of which the self of man resides. But when we study the history of the central nervous system, we find that it has been developed from the surface of the body, and this fact in itself argues, as all the other known facts do, that its first business is to receive communications from the outside world. At the present time, these communications take very definite lines, which we call the senses. It is by the senses that we gain all our knowledge of outside things, and it is upon the delicacy of the senses that, in the first place, the high development of the human being depends. We have reason to believe that this delicacy is, in the main, a matter of the brain itself, rather than of the channels from the world to the brain. But in any case, it must be distinctly understood that this quality of sensitiveness is so invaluable that all the higher qualities of mankind are built upon it. It is no doubt possible to be unduly sensitive to a degree that upsets the balance of the mind. But then, nearly every good thing can be exaggerated. We hear so much today of people being too sensitive that it is worthwhile to remind ourselves how valuable sensitiveness really is. John Ruskin long ago pointed out, by observation of men and women, what we can prove by examination of the body, that delicacy of the senses is the foundation on which are built all the highest and best developments of human character. One of the most horrible consequences of what we at present call education, and of the dull routine through which so many of us are put, is that the beautiful delicacy of sense that enables children to respond to what is new and to notice the small differences between things becomes spoilt. The edge is blunted, so that many grown-up people go through the world having lost the sense of appreciating everything which made it such a wonderful, beautiful, and interesting place when they were children. Some day, when we learn what human beings really are, and we shall find better ways than those at present adopted in educating and dealing with children, and then we shall get better results. And now, having said so much, let us go on to study one by one our senses or highways of knowledge. It probably does not matter very much which sense we begin with, for the great principles are the same in every case. Only we may begin by noting the names of the various senses, and especially by distinguishing, as people usually do not, between the senses which communicate with the outer world and certain other senses which do not. The senses by which we know the outer world. The senses which communicate with the outer world are seeing, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. But nowadays, we have learnt that it is not sufficient merely to say touch, for there are several senses in the skin besides mere touch. We must at least add the heat sense, the cold sense, and the pain sense to the sense of touch. In addition to these senses, which communicate directly with the outer world, there are other senses by which the brain is informed about the body. Of course, in a way, we may say that, so far as the brain itself is concerned, the body is part of its outer world. These senses come from the organs inside the body, from the muscles and joints, and from certain wonderful little canals in the inner ear, which we shall study later. Now we can take the senses one by one, and we shall begin with hearing. We know that there is a special part of the brain concerned with hearing. If we were to use the word ear for the part of the body that really hears, we should certainly have to say that the real ear is in this part of the brain. The ordinary ear is on both sides of the brain, and the ear for music, as we say, is probably on the left side only in right-handed people, and on the right side only in left-handed people, though in great musicians the sensitive ear for music may perhaps be developed equally on both sides of the brain. The real ear in our brain that cannot hear at all. But we are quite certain that sound cannot be directly heard by this real ear in our brain. The part of the brain where we feel touch feels nothing if it is itself touched, and this is true of the senses generally. The brain only responds if the communication is made to it through the proper channel. So what we now have to study is the channel that leads from the outside to the hearing center in the brain. Perhaps the best use of the word ear would be to describe the whole structure from the surface of the body to the tiny nerve cells where the hearing is actually done. If we begin at the surface of the body, we find in ourselves and in most of the higher animals a pair of organs projecting from the head, which are the only parts of the organs of hearing that we can see, and which we therefore call the ears, though they are by far the least important of the whole organ of hearing, especially in ourselves. We have all observed a dog prick up its ears, and we soon learn that the real use of the ear, or, as we should properly say, the outer ear, is to catch waves of sound. It is the general rule that the outer ear is provided with small muscles by which it can be moved in various directions. This serves two purposes. First, it enables the animal to make the most of the sound that comes to it, for the sound waves are, to a certain extent, gathered up by the outer ear, and so are made rather more intense. Why animals prick up their ears at any sound. But the second great advantage of being able to move the outer ear is that it greatly helps to decide where a sound comes from. This is of great importance to such an animal as the antelope, which hears a sound and fears that it is the voice of a lion. We all have opportunities of observing how animals prick up their ears, and we can imagine them saying to themselves, "Wherever does that sound come from?" It is very interesting to find in ourselves three little muscles attached to the outer ear, by which it ought to be pulled in various directions. These muscles exactly correspond with those that we find in the lower animals, but in ourselves they have quite fallen out of use. Though they are small, they are still quite capable of moving the ear, but we do not use them. A few people have the power of moving one or both outer ears at will, but there is no record of any human being who ever moved his outer ears when he was straining to hear a sound, or when he was trying to judge the direction of a sound. We are able still to judge the direction of a sound, but we cannot do so anything like so well as the lower animals, and the reason, no doubt, is that our outer ears no longer help us. Still, we are able in some degree to compare the intensity of a sound in the two ears, and so we judge more or less where it comes from. If the sound is made at a point equally distant from both ears, we are quite at a loss. A simple and amusing experiment or game will prove this. An amusing game that teaches us a lesson in science. If someone is blindfolded, we can seat him in a chair and then make little noises and ask him to judge where they come from. As long as they are on one side, he will judge all right. But if we make the noises at the back of his neck, in the middle line of his body, or under his chin, he cannot tell the one from the other. Of course, we must not allow him to guess in other ways, as by the noise of our breathing or the warmth of our fingers, but we must endure that it is a pure test of answering correctly the position of the sound. We shall then find that he cannot distinguish between a sound made at the back of his neck and a sound made under his chin. If we try this experiment on one of those people who can move their ears, we shall find that he does not use his power for this purpose. But one of the lower animals could not possibly be deceived in such a case. By pricking its ears forwards and back, it would in a moment discover in which direction it heard the sound best. It would have no more difficulty in this case than when the sound was on one side. When the sound comes from the side, the animal judges, as we do, mainly by comparing the intensity of sound in the two ears. The centers of hearing in the brain that compare notes. This seems very simple, and we, none of us, have any difficulty in doing it, but it is wonderful all the same that the two hearing centers should be able to compare notes, so to speak, and when the left hearing center hears loudest, we should turn to the right, and when the right hearing center hears loudest, we should turn to the left. This is so because most of the nerve fibers cross the middle line of the body on their way to the brain. The outer ear is not entirely useless, even in ourselves, for if it is all filled up except just at the opening of the canal that runs inward, we hear less clearly. This experiment can easily be made. It shows us that to some small extent the outer ear is still useful as a sort of ear trumpet, though vastly inferior to that of most of the lower animals. From the outer ear there leads a little channel along which the sound waves pass. When we cleanse our ears, we cannot and do not wash this channel. It would be a very serious matter if we had to do so, for there would be grave risk of doing harm at its inner end. Yet as a rule, this channel is kept perfectly clear and opened, even though it is never washed. It is lined by tiny glands which produce a sort of wax, and as this wax passes outwards, it carries impurities away with it. We think of this wax as a rather unpleasant thing, but in reality it is a beautiful means of cleanliness and protection. At its inner end, this canal is closed entirely by a piece of thin, delicate membrane, which is exactly like a drum, and it is called the drum of the ear, or tympanum. The great importance of the drum of the ear. This drum is exceedingly important for its purposes of hearing, and it is a delicate thing. If it is injured, it is, as a rule, injured permanently, and the hearing is affected. It may be injured either from within or from without. Sometimes little children push beads or peas into their ears, and they may do much harm in that way. A child might have reason to regret for its whole life such a foolish action. When anything like a bead has been got into the ear, we should call in the doctor at once and not attempt to get it out ourselves. This precious drum of the ear is also liable to be injured from within. An earache in children, or indeed in anyone, should not be neglected, because it means, as a rule, more or less of a threat against the health of the eardrum. We shall understand this better when we see what is on the inner side of this drum. If we could see beyond the eardrum, we should find that it made one of the walls of a little space or chamber hollowed out inside one of the bones of the head. This space is known as the middle ear. The bone in which it and also the inner ear lies is called the petroeus bone, from the Greek word for rock, because it is the hardest bone in the whole body. This is interesting, because a hard bone must undoubtedly conduct waves of sound very much better than a softer one. The little tube that runs from the throat to the ear. The middle ear is filled with air, and naturally we must ask where the air comes from. The answer is that it comes from the throat. There runs from the back of the throat on each side a little tube which goes to the middle ear and conveys air to it. If we shut the mouth and hold the nose, and then make a sharp movement as if we were sneezing, we can feel something happening in our ears. This is because when we made that movement, we opened the little tubes and drove some air along them into the middle ears. It is a very important thing for the safety and health of the ear, and also for the immediate purposes of hearing, that the air pressure on both sides of the drum of the ear should be the same. If the air pressure were greater on the outside than the inside of it, the drum of the ear would be driven inwards and strained. If any disturbance in the throat or nose closes up these canals so that air cannot get along them, this is liable to happen. It is said that when we go quickly down the shaft of a coal mine, it is wise to make a swallowing movement a few times, because in swallowing we open the canals from the throat to the ear. The pressure of the outside air increases as we go down, and the drum of the ear is apt to be strained unless we open these little tubes and thus allow the air pressure on both sides of the drum to remain the same. Why a cold in the head causes deafness. Everyone knows that a cold in the head often causes deafness. The reason is that the cold, as we call it, spreads along the tubes that run to the ear. The lining of them becomes swelled up, and so they are closed and cannot do their duty of keeping the air pressure of the middle ear the same as the air pressure outside. Hence, the drum of the ear is strained and cannot vibrate as it should due to sound waves, and so we are deaf for the time. In more serious troubles of the nose and throat, such as may happen in scarlet fever, the middle ear may be invaded by the disease, and the drum of the ear may be broken through, and deafness for life is the result. It is probably quite fair to say that proper care and treatment from the first could prevent this very unfortunate result in every case. But the most remarkable thing that we find in the middle ear is a little chain of three tiny bones, much the smallest bones in the body, which are there for a very special purpose. They are called by Latin names, which mean the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup, and the stirrup especially is exactly like its name. The handle of the hammer lies against the drum of the ear. The hammer is joined to the anvil, and the anvil to the stirrup, and the foot of the stirrup lies against another sort of drum, which leads to the most wonderful place of all, the inner ear. How the hammer, anvil, and stirrup carry sounds to the inner ear. The business of this chain of bones is to carry sound waves across the middle ear. That is why it has to be filled with air, for otherwise they could not vibrate freely. Every time a sound wave causes the drum of the ear to vibrate, it sets in motion the hammer bone, which is fastened to it, and so the vibration goes on. If the joints between the bones become fixed, the hearing is spoilt in some degree. This may happen in old age. Lastly, we find two muscles, very tiny but very useful, which pass into the middle ear. They have opposite uses, and we call them into action, though we know nothing about it, according to whether we want to hear a sound more acutely or less acutely. One of them is so arranged that when it pulls, it tightens the drum of the ear. That makes the drum vibrate more energetically, and so we hear better. Whenever we strain to hear, we throw this little muscle into action. It is called by doctors the tensor tympani, which simply means the stretcher of the drum. The other muscle has just the opposite effect. It is attached to the stirrup bone in such a way that when it pulls, the bone cannot vibrate as well as usual. So when this muscle is in action, it interferes with the conduction of sound to the inner ear, and when a noise is unpleasantly loud, we throw this muscle into action. It is noticed that in certain cases where there is anything the matter with the nerve that supplies this muscle, loud sounds become unusually painful. That is all we need say about the middle ear. The more closely we study it, the more wonderful we find it, and we become almost inclined to think that there can be nothing quite so exquisite and perfect in the whole body until we come to study the inner ear, compared with which the middle ear is almost clumsy. The whole purpose of the chain of bones in the middle ear is to carry the sound waves from the drum on its outer wall to a similar sort of membrane on its inner wall, on the inside of which is the inner ear. The inner ear is filled with fluid, and every sound that we hear reaches the nerve of hearing by conduction through fluid. We think of sound as a wave in the air, and that is what it usually is. Yet in its last stage, before reaching our nerves, every sound we hear is made of waves in water. This has a special interest if we trace the history of the ear and notice how it has slowly developed from its early stages in the fish, which hears sound waves conveyed by water. The inner ear that is far more wonderful than the outer ear. The main part of the inner ear is a tiny and very delicate bony structure, rather like a snail shell. It is cut right through and shows us how the canal is arranged in a spiral. We must understand that all this is filled with fluid. When the foot of the little stirrup bone is thrown into vibration by a sound, it vibrates the membrane to which it is attached, and so there is started a series of rapid little taps to the fluid which is lying against the inner side of that membrane, and the waves thus started run right along this spiral coil. Now, when we carefully examine the inside of this coil with the aid of a microscope, we shall find that we have really come to the essential part of the machinery by which sounds are received. All the rest that we have studied is merely for conducting the sounds. The outer ear, the canal leading from it to the drum, the chain of bones, and the spiral canal filled with fluid are all mere arrangements for getting the sound in the best possible way to the ends of the nerve of hearing. We may compare all these parts of the ear with all the front parts of the eyeball, which we are going to study in a short time. These front parts simply serve to carry the light to the curtain at the back of the eye, where the nerve of vision begins or ends, whichever way we care to look at it, and the same is the case with the ear. The fibers of the inner ear that are like piano wires. But we have not yet actually reached the ends of the nerves of hearing. The little nerve fibers do not hang freely in the fluid of the spiral canal, for there is something in between. We find that along the whole length of the canal, stretched across it from side to side, there is a sort of platform made of delicate fibers. Their number runs into many tens of thousands. The canal gets narrower as it reaches the top of the spiral, and so these fibers get shorter. If the spiral were arranged flat in a straight line, which it doubtless would be but for the fact that a spiral takes up less room in the head, we should see that the fibers are very like a series of piano wires, or like those toy musical instruments made of strips of metal that are struck with little hammers. Many people suppose that there is a meaning in the resemblance of these fibers to a musical instrument. We know cases where people have been perfectly deaf to one or two notes of the piano, but could hear all the notes above and all the notes below. And in some of these cases, it has been found that the piano in the inner ear, so to speak, has been damaged in a way corresponding with the gap in the person's hearing. The little fingers of the ear that receive the waves of sound. Now, upon this whole length of this series of fibers, there are perched a number of small but wonderful cells, each of which has a few little things like short hairs sticking out from it, and these little fingers, or hairs, lie in the fluid of the spiral canal. Probably, It is these tiny, hair-like fingers that receive the waves of the fluid, and then something happens in the cells. Lastly, if we examine carefully the lower part of each of these cells, we find that the nerve of hearing, which has come to this place from the brain, has sent a few tiny fibers that end at the base of these cells. The fibers do not run into the cells, but the cells are, so to speak, perched upon the ends of the little nerve fibers. The journey of a sound from the outside world to the brain. Now we have actually traced the sound from the outer world to the ends of the nerve of hearing. We have seen the path of its conduction, sometimes along canals filled with air, sometimes along little bones, then along the canal of fluid, and lastly, through their hairs into certain special cells made for the purpose. Here we come to a point which very few people understand, and as it applies equally to all the senses, we must know it thoroughly. We might suppose that the next thing to happen would be that the sound, having got so far, runs along the nerves of hearing to the brain. Nothing of the sort occurs. Hitherto, we have been dealing with things that are wonderful and complicated enough, so complicated that what has been said is only a mere outline of the facts. But at this point, we have reached something compared with which all the rest is commonplace and simple. The sound which reaches the hair cells of the inner ear does not pass along the nerves of hearing, but it sets up in them a nerve current which runs to the brain. That nerve current is not a sound wave. It is utterly different in every way from a sound wave. But it is that current, and that alone, which excites the hearing cells in the brain and enables us to say that we hear. If we examine the nerve of hearing through a powerful microscope, it looks like any other nerve. But to say merely that it is capable of carrying a nerve current which we translate into sound is not to state half the mystery, for we must consider the infinite variety of sounds that we can hear and distinguish. The many nerve currents that pass to the brain when we hear music. What must be the number and delicacy and variety of the nerve currents passing along these nerves of hearing when a great musician conducts a big orchestra and can hear every instrument separately and know whether it is in tune or not? How delicate must be the varieties of current that are possible when we remember that it is scarcely possible for us to mistake the voice of one friend for that of another, and that, after 20 years, hearing a mere syllable pronounced will tell us that someone is present whom we have not seen for all that time. So long as we confine ourselves to the study of the inner ear, and see the tens of thousands of fibers of different lengths, and the hundreds of thousands of hair cells which it contains, we are not so much puzzled, because here is something which seems fitted to correspond with the powers of the sense of hearing. There ought to be the power of noticing slight differences in sounds by means of an organ so complicated as the inner ear is. But the inner ear would not be of the least use without the nerve of hearing, and every one of these tiny differences in sounds means a tiny difference in the something that runs along the simple little white threads that serve to make up this nerve. The great marvel of nerve currents that very few people think about. Language cannot say how wonderful these things appear to those who really think about them, and it is a great pity that so many of us should go through the world hearing, seeing, and moving, and yet never giving a thought to these marvels upon which our lives depend. The fact that nerve currents, and not sound currents, travel along the nerve of hearing is a general truth of all the senses. It is not light that travels along the nerve of vision. The place in the brain where we see is enveloped and lives always in utter darkness. No light ever reaches it. What reaches it is the nerve currents from the nerves of vision. All that the light does in entering our eyes is to do something which starts those nerve currents in the ends of the nerve of vision. And all that sound does in entering our ears is to start certain nerve currents in the ends of the nerve of hearing. When we study the variety of sensations that are possible for us, we see that a nerve current, though we talk about it so easily, must be nearly the most complicated and wonderful thing in the world, compared with which the waves of sound or light or electricity must be considered quite simple. The End. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.